Tonight's session is to look at the monastic movement. I've mentioned monasticism to you various times. From the ascension of Christ until 325 AD, that major section of history, we have the composition of Scripture. We have persecution. And we have a lot of internal conflict within Christianity over competing ideas. The Greek system of Gnosticism that elevated the spirit and said that what you do in the body doesn't matter. And Marcionism, Marcion was the guy who said, I like Jesus and the God he talks about, but I don't like the Old Testament God. They're not one and the same. And the church is wrestling through those kind of internal, what we would say, theological issues of how do we define Christianity? What does Christianity do with Judaism? How far do we hold on to Judaism? How much of it do we retain? And the Judaizers were there to say, you can be a Christian, but you've got to still remain a law-abiding Jew. And Paul is saying, we're saved by grace through faith, not a law-keeping gospel. Here you go, Sean. So those are major events that are going on. Christianity is not legal. Christianity is targeted by many of the emperors. It would run like this. The church would begin to flourish, accumulate some measure of goods and wealth, and even establish a building during maybe a 40 or 50 year lapse of persecution. The next emperor comes on the scene and says, that's easy fruit. They are not legal. I just take it from them. And so he comes to that area and says, I got an edict. You've got to burn incense to Caesar worship, and they won't do it. So he seizes their property and their goods. And so it just back and forth. And because of that unrest and lack of sanction, then Christianity can't really communicate as well. You can't everybody get together. You don't have books. You know, you have very few scrolls or copies of books and pieces. There's no official Bible for the Christianity because there's no official organization. Who declares? The apostles? The apostles have all died before they recognize that Jesus isn't coming back, before all of them died. We had a go-to guy. You know, we have, you know, the various apostles who spread out all around the Mediterranean Sea. Now, so that's a lot of stuff going on for 300 years. And then in 315, Christianity is called the Edict of Milan. The place, these are just where the edict was established or signed or that sort of thing, just like the Council of Nicaea. Nicaea is where the location is. In 315, there was an edict of toleration for Christianity. And it's in 325, 10 years later, that Constantine adopts Christianity and, flies under that banner. And he convenes the Council of Nicaea. They get there and he finds out rather than Christianity will now be the cement of the empire, Christianity is enormously divided. You've got people in various locations. There was a guy by the name of Arius in Alexandria, Egypt, who said Jesus wasn't divine. And others saying, yes, he was. And so that was a major controversy at Nicaea. And they tried to resolve it. It's called the Arian controversy, coming off of the name of Arius, the guy who was the principal spokesperson for Jesus is not divine. Present day Jehovah's Witnesses, they're Arian in their structure that Jesus is not divine. And so that's still around. So Arianism was fought at Nicaea but wasn't resolved. Even after Nicaea, Constantine embraces Arian bishops. And then just before he died, wasn't he baptized by an Arian bishop? Do you remember reading that? I thought Well, he got baptized just days before he died, or weeks, and very right at the very end. And the reason that they waited for baptism was because they believed there was no forgiveness for sins after baptism. And so you had to get, you know, start all over again kind of thing. So you got to kind of wait to the end. You can call it, you know, run too short if you're not careful enough. Now, okay, now you would have thought that when the emperor gives an edict of toleration, and then when Constantine says, you're going to be the religion of the state, everybody would have been excited about that. But they were not. Why? You're fraternizing with what? Who's persecuted you for the last 300 years? State. Okay? And now, as happened in Judaism, the sect of Judaism that was the ruling party, ruling priesthood and all that sort of thing at the time of Jesus was the Sadducees. And they would purchase the right of the high priesthood from the Roman authority. They had a position of, let's get along instead of fight with our oppressor. And so whenever this, they said, okay, we're going to legalize you. Okay, not only legalize you, you're going to make you the state religion. And a lot of people said, you're mixing the secular with the, what other S word?
Sacred.
You're taking the sacred and the secular and you're putting them together. And what will happen is you will compromise the gospel. And so there, instead of there being a birthday cake and candles and euphoria and, oh, now we, you know, we're not only going to be tolerated, we're going to get the blessing of the emperor. And a lot of people said, you've just sold the church out. And so there was a mass exodus by the thousands of people from the church. Because they said the church has now, become an institutional world. You know, you're going to be full of institutional worldliness, because now you are, you know, if the leading bishops are meeting with the in the palace of the king, what are you doing? You're eating with the king. You're drinking and eating, and you're doing all this stuff and all the social protocols and all that sort of thing. And we're focused on that. And if you do it just right, you win favors of the emperor. And if the bishopric at Antioch is open, guess what? If I'm in league with the emperor, what do I get? Just like today, you get a political appointment. You know, and so boom, they began, you know, so it wasn't, you know, we would have thought this would be the greatest thing that ever happened, but it caused a reaction. And so at first people just left the church, and as individuals, they went out into the desert. And the English word that we get for hermit is built off of the same word for desert. So hermits were people who went to the desert. And they went to the desert for a lot of reasons. If you look at your outline, first of all, there was no accountability because they were out there wandering around the wilderness, so they weren't paying taxes. And taxation has always been a heavy issue for every culture. And you know, if you're a vassal nation, then you're paying a lot of taxes to support the ruling power. And there's no family burden. You weren't having to raise mom and the kids and pay the bills and provide the groceries. So it left you with a whole lot less to have to work for. And then they began to say the church has become culturized. And as they have, they're moving away from the real standards of Christianity. And so the only way to really follow the teaching of Jesus is in isolation. And they need the time then just to focus on God instead of making a living, raising a family and all that sort of thing. Now, monasticism, if you go back up to the top, we talk about monasticism being an ascetic movement. Asceticism is severe self-discipline of all form of indulgences in order to pursue spiritual goal. Self-denial, self-mortification. Now, the period of history during the persecution, people stood out who were willing to go and become what? Martyrs. And those who were not killed in martyrdom but were tortured, they would accept torture rather than give up the book to be burned. And so a lot of people, there were a lot of people in the church who had an eye gouged out, had been severely burned, had been, you know, ravaged by dogs, had been, you know, they bore the scars of standing up for the kingdom. And these people who stood the test in the face of persecution became, if they died, they became saints, but they were the go-to people. Now that Christianity is legal, now that Christianity is married to the state, we're the holy people. You know, who are the people that we can trust to go to and that sort of thing. And so the monastic movement became that. And just as those people in the time of persecution endured physical harm, it's now physical harm by what? Self. Self-inflicted. So the measure of the spiritual person was how much he could self-mortify himself. Now, you'll read stories about these people that were retreating to the desert, and they'd live in caves. They'd hardly sleep. They'd hardly eat. They would not allow themselves to have social interaction. They would not have any pleasures. They went out of their way to wear coarse clothing so that they couldn't be comfortable. And they were always hungry, malnourished, and at the point of death. And when you found one of these guys and he looked like death warmed over, you said, here's the holy man. Now, in that we understand that during the time of the first three centuries, Gnosticism, which elevated the spirit and depreciated the body, that's exactly what's happening here. They're saying we mortify the flesh in order that we can pursue things spiritually. They didn't get that from Judaism. Judaism was big on marriage. Adultery was a big crime. And fornication was a big crime. And procreation was major to the Jewish people. And if a guy didn't have children before he died, somebody was going to make sure he had offspring, lineage, that sort of thing. Now, anything to do with sex, even procreation, was evil and wrong. It's a pleasure and you know, and that sort of thing. And so, if I'm going to follow the Sermon on the Mount, which is not even to lust or not to be angry, then as I share with you on Sunday, the best way to do that is live in a cave by yourself. You might cuss at the rocks that are dripping water on you, but the facts are you're not, there ain't nobody to look at and there's nobody to be mad at. And so they said the only way we can walk by the teaching of Jesus and be true Christians is to live this kind of lifestyle. Okay. Now, there are many places in the Sermon on the Mount under item 3, the call to New Testament Christianity. That's what they were saying. The church has now married itself to the state and we're withdrawing and going to go and pursue New Testament Christianity. So they go to the book, they go to the Sermon on the Mount especially. Jesus said, do not be anxious about life. Deny yourself, take up your cross, follow me. And so denial of self became the major mantra. How much can I deny myself? I'll deny myself food. I'll deny myself water. I'll deny myself comforts. I mean, I'll sleep on rocks instead of sleeping on something that's soft. It sounds funny, but at the same time, it is admirable in the point of these people honestly believed this was the path to purity. Okay? There were guys who would stand on one foot. without sleeping or eating or drinking until they collapsed. Now, and people would revere them for it. And if somebody retreated to the desert and lived there, there's one guy here, his name is Paul of Thebes. He lived in a cave for 100 years. He was 113 years old when he died. I mean, and so this guy, you know, like you see these TV commercials where these people climb the mountain to go to talk to the Tibetan monk, you know, it's up there, it's got hair down to his knees and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's what these people became. You know, they were so serious about their faith that they would deny themselves everything. And so the people would go and say, after 50 years sitting here in this cave, what have you decided about God? Because they said, I'm not going to spend my time making a living, raising a family. I'm going to spend my time praying and thinking, meditating on God. And so these people, so like one guy, this guy named St. Anthony, who they call the father of monasticism, when he read that Jesus said to the rich young ruler, go and sell all you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me, that's what he did. He was a family of means, sold all he had and went and said, I must go follow you. And so he went out into the desert. And people would come and want to hear from him and talk to him, get spiritual guidance from him. And somebody'd come back and say, this guy's got it together. You need to go talk to him. And so people started flocking to his cave. Pretty soon, his cave was a epic center. And so he would retreat again and try to go hide somewhere else. And then they'd find him. And then all of a sudden, everybody'd make their trip to go see St. Anthony. And then he'd retreat again and all of that sort of thing. There was a guy named Simeon who lived on a mountain by himself, and he did the proverbial ball and chain that he tied to his leg. He drug it around everywhere he went and whatever he was doing, trying to find something to eat or whatever, or to get water or do it. And that wasn't enough mortification, and that wasn't enough denial. He put a pole up in the air 60 foot tall with a yard wide platform on it, 3x3, and he lived on that pedestal for 36 years. Now, people would come and sit to bottom that pedestal and ask him questions and talk to him and that sort of thing. Now, you know, once again, that sounds just beyond thinking. And yet, for them, it was taking seriously the command of Jesus. Don't lust, don't be angry, be not anxious for the things of this life. And the birds in the air, they don't toil, but God feeds them. And so they went out in the desert and said, God will feed me. And they lived out there where they ate nuts, berries, leaves, tree bark, or whatever they ate. A lot of times these people would start getting followers who would come, and they would occasionally bring them food, you know, that kind of thing. But they went out of their way for that denial of self. How far does denial of self go? Well, I mean, even the comforts of sleep. And one of the reasons, you know, sleep deprivation in World War II was what in nowadays is waterboarding. If they wanted to torture a soldier and get him to be able to get the information out of him, you did sleep deprivation. And every time you get ready, every time you start dreaming, you wake him up, and he gets crazy. Pretty soon he can't remember. He's not supposed to talk, and he talks. But, you know, I believe some of these people didn't sleep enough to even keep their brain functioning. That's when they didn't eat enough. They were always malnourished. And my grandson would like this part. They had this big thing on not bathing. Now, I don't know how you draw a crowd and influence people if you don't bathe at all, but I mean, they would say, they would allow, you know, that once again is a pleasure. That is an indulgence. That is something you do for yourself. No, you do it for other people. So they don't have to smell you, you know what I mean? You know, or, good thing he was on a 60 foot pole up in the air. You didn't have to get very close to him. But the point being is, that's, you know, one guy would take a bath, And he said, well, you're doing a pleasure. You know, taking a bath. I don't bathe. I wouldn't give myself that pleasure because I'm supposed to deny self. And in the middle of this, then there were these hermits that are out there in the desert and the caves, and they lived in caves and trees and in holes in the ground or on the top of a pole or whatever. There began to be the feeling that there were two roads of Christianity, the high road to Christianity and the low road. Not everybody can be a hermit. That is the high road, and it's going to get you to your destination better and quicker. The low road is what the common folks follow, and you come to the people who are traveling the high road to get guidance for how to travel the low road. There's no support in the New Testament for high road, low road Christianity. We're all called to the same path. And, number six here in our outline, they lived in trees, caves, holes, tombs, seldom slept, ate, seldom bathed, wore coarse clothing. Their goal was to outdo one another in discomfort. As I said earlier, the competition often of just standing on one foot, see who could, you know, endure the pain or last the longest, that sort of thing. Now, that went on for a while, and there were still some who did that, but after a while, you run out of isolation. Why? You can't get isolated because I was at a farm meeting this week, and they were talking about these predatory vultures. They're a migratory bird, and so they're protected by federal law. You can't shoot them like a hawk or an eagle or anything else, or a sparrow that migrates. You're not allowed to shoot a blue jay if he's swarming you at your door. You're not allowed to, but people do. But anyhow, the point being was, they said you can't shoot them, and of course everybody there owns about 15 weapons, and said, don't tell me what I can't shoot that's eating my calf, they said, but the problem we have is our farms aren't as isolated as they used to be. You shoot one of them, and you got a near door neighbor that's a Peta, whatever those people are, he's going to be calling somebody saying, this guy's up here shooting these predatory birds, and the fine's $15,000. And so, the number one deterrent to these buzzards is to kill one and hang it from a tree, and they'll leave. But, you know, how do you get the killed one? The guy said, the TWRA guy said, I got 50 carcasses in my freezer. I'll send you one. I said, you're allowed to shoot around them to scare them. I said, what if I shoot and they fly up into the path of my stray shot? So we had a lot of fun with the meeting with that. But the point being was, we're no longer isolated. It's just like, you know, there was a time when you drag an old cow up on a trailer and take him off to the slaughterhouse. Now you got somebody who's taking pictures and showing pictures and all this. And we shouldn't be inhumane anyhow. But the point being was, when thousands retreat to the desert, what happens? All of a sudden you got a community out there. I mean, you're going to bump into somebody when you go looking for water or for acorns or whatever else you're looking for. You're going to bump into somebody. So pretty soon they started gathering in little groups. 8 or 10 of them says, well, you know, we'll just all kind of live in this area, and then we know where the food sources are and that sort of thing. So we moved from individual monasticism to communal style monasticism. Now, at first, hermits wanted nothing to do with the church. They withdrew. Once the monasticism, I'm down to number 7 there, monasticism became organized and related to the church. It became the source for bishops. They would come to a monastery somewhere and they'd say, which guy is the best at discomfort? Which guy shows that self-discipline more than anybody else? See, what they were trying to say was self-discipline of self-mortification shows how serious you are to want to pursue God. I get rid of the flesh out of my way so I can pursue God wholly. Now, 347, 420, that's, you know, not long after Nicaea, the guy by the name of Jerome, he was a person of means, and then he left and joined the monastic movement. And he was the kind of the starting point for adding scholarship to the monastic movement. Now, here, let me point you to something. If you've ever watched these movies of these monks in these monasteries, they worship three or four times a day, which may mean simply just going to the meeting room and singing three or four hymns and reciting a scripted prayer. But then at various times they have different kinds of things. But, you know, as you watch movies of these people, they're very, you know, this chanting of hymns and music, that sort of thing. And but the monastic movement, once you got people starting joining these groups, then if you were a fugitive, where was a good place to hide? You go join the monastery. And if you're near to well and don't want to work, you go join the monastery. And so the monasteries began to have issues and problems. There were people there whose motivation wasn't quite holy. They weren't pursuing God. They were just pursuing an easy road. They always had somebody to cook for them. They always had food and shelter from the storm and that sort of thing. And so it has a development. But now what you need to know is once Jerome added scholarship to the monastic movement, saying, we got more time than anybody. We need to study. And Jerome was trying to be celibate, and he said the only way he could be celibate is to study intensely. So he decided to teach himself Hebrew, and that'd make you go crazy, and Greek, and then he was proficient in Latin, and he translated the first translation of the Bible into Latin. It's called the Latin Vulgate, which means common, for the common people. The Bible written in the language of the common people, because we've left Greek behind. And so the monastic movement, then all of a sudden, it became, how studious are you? People would not sleep for days, and they would study. And so the monasteries became libraries, collection of documents. And if it wasn't for monasteries, we would not have an accurate scripture. They're the ones who did the copying, you know, the manuscript copies of the scriptures and produced them for people and that sort of thing. And, of course, they did it with calligraphy and all these other fancy-style writings and all the kind of ornate stuff that they did. But so then once the monastery became a scholastic center and they're copying scriptures and doing all this sort of thing, then whoever is leading the monastery ought to be leading the church. And so the church would come and get somebody there to come and be the bishop. You know, like Luther, he was part of the monastic movement before he became a priest. St. Francis of Assisi, he was a monk. Benedict, and you know, in the Catholic Church even today, they'll have an order of who the priests are. The one down here on the road, is it Benedictine or Franciscan? They got it. It's on the sign out there. Order of the Franciscan monk. Well, St. Francis of Assisi formed a monastery. And, of course, then the monasteries began to have the same problem the church would have. It would become immoral. What do you do with the women? And they try to start women monasteries, you know, for the order of the nuns. They can call them nuns then, not till later Catholicism. But anyhow, and there was always the problem of all these guys there and everybody wrestling with their sexuality, and the neighbor people, village people, knew the monasteries always had money and they always had food. And so you could go there and get what you wanted if you're willing to give what they wanted. And so the monasteries would become a lot of times immoral. And so there's all, as you're going along in the history of the monastic movement, there's always the need for reform. You know, y'all have let all these people go out and do all this fornication and all this other stuff. And so the monastic movement is what we call white martyrdom. After 325, nobody could get killed for the faith. And so there was no way to distinguish yourself, go down in history as a saint who died by the lions in the amphitheater or was burned at the stake like Polycarp or any of the other church fathers. And so now it's white martyrdom, self-inflicted martyrdom. How close can you get to killing yourself in denying yourself in order to show that you're really serious about God? Now, we swing that pendulum to the other side, to the point now that the role models during this period of history were people who were serious about their faith, so serious that they denied themselves any kind of pleasure, comfort, or anything else. They spent their hours and hours studying, reading the scriptures, praying, meditating, that sort of thing. And now we say, oh, that's stupid. And now Christianity swung over here to the side is, it's God's job to pamper and pet me. Give me everything I want. Now, white martyrdom is self-inflicted martyrdom, and they became the role models for Christianity. Today's role models are Joel, Creflo, and Benny. Joel says, ain't nothing going to happen but blessings. Creflo says, like my last name says, God wants to fill your pocket full of dollars. And Benny said, nobody's going to get sick because I'm going to come around and you're going to pay me money and I'm going to make sure everybody's well. Was he a Jew? I thought he was Indian.
Born in Israel. He was born in Israel. He was Jewish.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, pretty sure.
I thought he was Mindy all this time. Okay. Well, anyhow, but you see how the pendulum has swung so far? You got that over here now. The role model is Joel. He's 24/7 on TV. And everybody's, stepping up, not watching him, okay? And he's going to tell you, this is Christianity. God's just waiting for a chance to bless you. Now, okay, number 9 there. There are sharp controversies within the church that lasted for 150 years after Nicaea. Okay, in 450, which is 125 years after Nicaea, at Nicaea we're trying to wrestle through the divinity of Christ. Well, we're still at Chalcedon in 450 trying to get that laid to rest 125 years later. So Arians were in and out of power. And over this next 150 year period when the monastic movement, now you need to understand that the church was still going on. There were people who were still going to church. And there was a church at Antioch and Ephesus and Thessalonica and Rome and Alexandria, Egypt, and Hippo, North Africa, Carthage, and all these places. There were churches, just like Paul went around planted the churches and wrote letters to the churches and all that. But at the same time, there was this monastic movement, a lay withdrawal from the church. And at first it was all laymen who were saying the leadership has sold out and married itself to the culture and to the political powers, and so we withdraw. But the church is still going on, okay? And pretty soon, the monastic movement begins to have an influence on the church because that's where the leadership comes out of the monastic movement. But I put a note here under number 9. Not only were there controversies in the church, the Arians were in and out of power. Arianism never faded completely away. Like I said, even to today in Jehovah's Witnesses, it still flourishes. But there was political instability. In one 70-year span, there were 23 different emperors, 20 of whom were assassinated. Now that would provide some real instability. So everything is going, in various directions. Now, The hermit was life in isolation. Monasteries were life in common. The word hermit comes from the word desert. The word monk comes from the word alone, although they were alone in community. Now, there were orders of discipline in these monasteries. Everybody had to work. One of their big things was idleness is the enemy of the soul. Not spoken much around in these days, you know. Idleness is a way of life for a lot of people. Just all I need is Kurt to bring me my check. You know, just make sure it's in the box on the third of every month. Now, in 480, Benedict organized a reform of monasticism. Like I said, he gets out of direction. St. Francis become the Franciscan monks. Augustinian monks are from Augustine's influence as a monk. The monastic movement is a literal interpretation of the New Testament. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow. Now, they are a literal interpretation of that, and they are a reaction to the church merging itself with the society. Now, they provide, I mean, some of the, you know, there have been some recent manuscript finds in monasteries like in Egypt and various places where they have knocked down a wall and found a bunch of scrolls in there that have been around for 2,000 years. These monasteries have produced some major advantages to it. It was in the monastery when a person didn't have to do the normal working to make a living kind of thing. We could spend hours studying the languages, studying comparing all these manuscripts that come in from all the various directions and all the various places and cleaning all that up. They provided an enormous service. The point being, though, is the monastic movement, if everybody joins the monastery, what happens in 40 years?
Huh? They're all in the cave.
Well, there's no procreation. I mean, I don't remember, I think it's Benedict, but I don't remember exactly. But anyhow, he said that the only reason that women should have children is so that they can produce virgins, men and women, to live in the monasteries. You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, somebody's got to take the low road so they can produce these virgins. They're going to live in the monasteries. And, you know, there's no question that for 1,000 years, the number one sin was sex. That's the number one issue everybody's wrestling, dealing with, and how you deal with that is the mark of your spirituality. And, taking seriously the words of Jesus is not to be taken lightly. They tried to take seriously. They tried to recapture Christianity. Gnosticism tried to take it over. Marcionism tried to take it over. Arianism tried to take it over. On went all these takeover movements. And there was always somebody to fight there for the truth. Judaism married itself to the culture, lost its direction. And so this movement was important to try to say, we got to get back. They swung the pendulum too far, and they didn't have a Christianity that was for living. It was for special designation where you're the great spiritual person. Okay. Now, there's never been anything in the scriptures that says if you deprive yourself, you'll get closer to God. Now, when you deny self, it's to deny those selfish interests. But eating is not a selfish interest. You know, being clean is not a selfish interest. You know, it's not something that puts you in conflict with God. And it's almost like I got to prove to God how serious I am by how much pain I'm willing to endure. And that's the furthest thing from God's agenda. You don't prove to God how much you love him by how much pain you can endure. Because God said, Jesus came, that he said, I came that I might give you life. And how much of it? Abundantly. Well, you got to read that one too. Don't be anxious about this world, meaning that we do have to make a living, and we do need to have some means of being taken care of when we get older. But the point being is, that's not our focus, and that's not the overwhelming, consuming passion of life. That's all that life is. It's just feeding myself while I'm getting along and have enough to take care of me when I get old. Well, you know, so everything has to be balanced. I'll come again Sunday and look at the Sermon on the Mount. I tried to touch on some of those controversial sections were there last week, and I'll touch on a couple more of them and talk just a little bit more about what Jesus said about the Sermon on the Mount and why it's a centerpiece of his teaching. But monasticism, it flourished and went on, and as far as Catholicism is concerned, the monastery concept and the monastic movement, they're still, I think the guys down here at the Catholic Church have a vow of poverty. The only thing they own is they don't even own the shirt that's on their back. And
how many years did this flourish?
It's still a part of what?
The real out in the desert.
The hermits probably went on for maybe 100 years. But the communal living, the setting up a monastery, quickly eclipsed the individual isolation.
And they're still
monasteries. Yeah, well, in Catholicism, they have the Benedictine order, they have the Franciscan order. You know, if you're going to become a Catholic priest, you join one of these orders, and you go somewhere, and they have a training center. And you'll be trained as a Franciscan or a Benedictine. And once again, each of these named people, like Augustinian monk or Franciscan monk was St. Francis or Benedict, each of them had a different rule of discipline of what you did. How much you worked each day. You know, I have a friend whose son went to a Catholic order out in the Midwest. And they required everyone to work out, physically work out, go in the gym and work out, exert energy and that sort of thing. And he got so excited about working out, he left the order and came back here and walk around and see how big I am now. You know, but all these have different orders about study, about work, about, they began to realize that we're going to all die off if we don't bathe and keep clean and eat and sleep. And so our job, you know, once the movement shifted away from how much pain can I endure is going to show you how spiritual I am, then when scholasticism entered the monastery, now it's how smart I am. How much have I studied? How many languages can I read? And how many books have I absorbed? And so the monastery became then known for the high caliber thinking, the high caliber in terms of, the people who translated the scriptures and stuff like that, they came out of monasteries. They're the only people that could spend 14 hours a day studying the Greek language to be able to be good enough to, you know, do all that kind of stuff. Well, so there was a shift in that to how dedicated am I now as a scholar and that sort of thing.
Very prideful to me, which is who we are. You know, we're
going to
take pride in something.
Well, go ahead.
Another thing is that I'm
glad that they saved and did all they did, but there are examples where they copied things like the Gospel of Thomas. They copied a lot of things and buried them in a jar. They found them, what, like 1947 or something like that out in the desert. And the Pope told them to burn them. But they didn't do it. They took it out in the desert. And that's one of the reasons we have all this, what do you call it, pseudepigraphal writings and the Gospel of Thomas especially. I mean, before that, it was just a fragment. Now they've got most of it, you know, in existence. If they hadn't put that in a jar, we probably wouldn't know it. But there were like 54 books, forbidden books. And so once they began doing that scholarly work, they had to make sure that they weren't copying stuff that didn't have any value.
Right. Yeah, and back to Joy's statement about pride, you know, the people who were leaders of monasticism, they would, the people would come and say, you need to come and be the bishop at Antioch. And he said, you know, I have no interest in that. I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. And it was almost a forced, we need you, got to have you kind of thing. The church is in bad shape. You're trying to reshape Christianity. Well, we're better to do it than where the people live. And so it was that kind of thing. A lot of these people were very sincere in terms of their dedication to God. But, and then once they left the monastery and get back into the church, it's back to church politics. And, you know, shifting, maneuvering. And so, anyhow, anything that happens that's good gets contaminated and it has to have reform. And so the church has a need of constant reformation. Well, monastic movement, you need to know that's there and it's still a part of Catholicism as their priest orders are a part of a particular monastic order. And they did the scriptures and various other things. And then they were the scholars wrote commentaries and various other things. Okay. And a lot of the important people of church history that we know about, like Luther and others, they served time as a monk in a monastic order and got their start there. They were searching for truth and searching for true spirituality and trying to find some way to deal with the fact that they were trying to live celibate. The order of celibacy destroyed Christianity. You know, in order to be pure to God, I had to be celibate. And that dimension of their life, they wrestled and fought with all their days. And
well, something similar to that happened to the Shakers. They sort of went out of business, so to speak, because
they were celibate.
Yeah. But you don't see any Shakers at all. Their rocking chairs are around, but they're not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyhow, it's an important movement, and there's some good things out of it and not so good things.